Okay, well, let's get started. I'm hopeful everyone can see the introductory chart. Good morning. I'm Rob Gleason, the Chapter Chair of the Santa Clarita Valley Chapter for the Aerospace and Defense Forum, and so happy to have our featured speaker today. This chapter represents the Santa Clarita Valley. We are located approximately 30 miles north of Los Angeles, so we're within Los Angeles County. And this is our ninth chapter session since our inception back in September of 2019. So excited to present our ninth chapter session. Our last four have been via Zoom with the pandemic. Traditionally, we hold our chapter meetings in person in Santa Clarita on the campus of College of Canyons. There's a nice photo there, a beautiful facility, and we hope to get back to that maybe as next year sometime as we get through this pandemic. So we're conducting our sessions via Zoom, and we also have national chapter sessions as well. So it's an opportunity for us to kind of broaden our outreach a little bit and describe a little bit more about who we are and where we're located. As a nonprofit, we have our valued sponsors and our community outreach to make the Aerospace and Defense Forum go. So in doing so, I'd like to recognize our sponsors, Wells Fargo. Marlon Profeta is on our committee board and can't join us today, but we want to thank Wells Fargo for their sponsorship. And also SCEDC, which is the Santa Clarita Economic Valley, Santa Clarita Valley Economic Development Corporation, under the leadership of Holly Schroeder, the CEO, and she's also on our panel. So I want to thank her and her valued team, Sue, and everybody for what they do. They're actually located at the College of Canyon campus and is a wonderful sponsor. In addition, I want to recognize our Santa Clarita Valley Chapter Steering Committee, who volunteer their time and they arrange for speakers. And we used to do tours as well, so we hope to get back to that next year as well. But I want to thank that team, in particular today, Mr. Jim Savitz, for arranging today's speaker. So a little bit about who we are. We're a 10-year organization. And I think what's unique about the Aerospace Defense Forum is we're not a big national chain. We are local to our businesses in the aerospace and defense business. And we try to make that connection. So we have these smaller committee sessions to be able to bring more face-to-face and kind of B2B in terms of the interaction and producing community. We have over 24 members, 100 members, I should say, and we have 8 chapters. We're the newest chapter in the Santa Clarita Valley, just north of Los Angeles, but there are also chapters in L.A., San Fernando Valley, South Bay, Orange County, San Diego, Arizona, and Dallas-Fort Worth, with some plans to expand further as we get through this crisis. We conduct monthly meetings, and I think we're all looking forward to some of these pictures again, where we can get back together face to face. The middle picture is actually our facility there at College of Canyons, and it's a wonderful place to connect. We usually serve breakfast, and so we look forward to getting back to some of those normal times in the future. But a great organization and a way to kind of have a local feel on the major issues that affect aerospace and defense industry. So let's talk a little bit about today, and we have a meaty topic and an important one that's really going to impact all of us in the defense business particularly. So just a couple points here. I think everybody's on mute, and so what we're going to do at the end of this session is address questions. So I ask that you, as we go through the content, and Jacob has a lot of information, that you jot it down. And I'll be reviewing those questions, and we'll have a Q&A with me bringing up those questions. So please use the chat feature in Zoom. So today's topic is brought to you by the CMTC. It stands for California Manufacturing Network. And they're an organization that provides solutions to quality marketing, lean process development, HR, business development, and cybersecurity. So a lot of meaty topics, and they work with a lot of organizations throughout California and beyond. Kathy McIntyre, I know you're online, and I know you can't talk, since we have you on mute, but I wanted to mention Kathy. She is our local client advisor who serves the Santa Clarita Valley and has been active in our chapter. So I want to thank Kathy for her participation, and she'll be reachable via our network list at the conclusion of this meeting as we send that information out. So now to our feature topic. We had a captivating title, as many authors do, to hook you in, and it's called Set Up to Fail, Cybersecurity Compliance in the Last Mile of the DoD Supply Chain. And what we're really going to talk about here with Jacob is the changing landscape by the Department of Defense, the DoD, and some of the changes in DFARS. And we just saw an example yesterday where Twitter was hacked, and I won't be asking for cryptocurrency today, but cybersecurity is more important now than ever. We have a changing landscape, and we are all connected. We've had topics in the past about blockchain. We've talked about advanced manufacturing. There's so many elements that interconnect us, and the DFARS will be updated, and there'll be a compliance element. So we'll, Jacob's going to get into that and what that means to all of us in the manufacturing supply chain. Jacob, a little bit about Jacob Horn, just a wonderful advocate and an experienced person. He is a consultant for the CMTC organization. He specializes in really kind of demystifying and facilitating compliance to DFARS and cybersecurity and CMMC, which is the certification element for showing compliance. Previously, he worked for the U.S. Navy over 12 years in cybersecurity, and while on active duty as an intelligence analyst and cyber operations planner, he worked for NSA and was also commander of the Carrier Strike Group 5, where he was responsible for cybersecurity for the Battle Force 7th Fleet assets. He then moved into civilian world and still worked closely with the U.S. military for the U.S. Army 516th Signal Brigade, where he provided 24/7 cyber incident handling for the U.S. Pacific Command Theater information grid. So our cybersecurity folks never get a break. As we know, there are threats out there, and it is a 24/7 job. He's now doing many things. He worked for Northrop. He's done extension training for the UCLA Extension 6-month cybersecurity boot camp. And so we want to welcome Jacob. We want to first thank him for his U.S. service, by the way. And he's a valued asset to this country. And with that, Jacob, I'd like to introduce you. Can you hear me?
Great. Thanks, Rob. Is my audio okay?
Audio is great. So let me just switch over to you.
Great. Let's bring this up here so everybody can see. That way they don't have to just be forced to look at me the entire time. Everything look good?
Perfect.
Great. All right. Thanks, everybody. Thanks for being here. I know it's relatively early on the West Coast, and this is a relatively dense topic. There are several large pieces of the background to cybersecurity compliance for DoD manufacturers that we need to sync up in order to paint a clear picture of exactly what type of corner we've all been backed into. So anybody familiar with the term set up to fail knows that there's a bit of a double meaning here. And unfortunately, when we go out and work with small manufacturers in the field on their cybersecurity compliance, when we start to tell people exactly what their obligations look like and what the situation actually is that they face, it can feel like you've been set up or someone's trying to actively undermine your ability to get into compliance and to approach something that looks like a secure state. But as we'll see when we trace the timeline of how we ended up here and several key events along the way, we have sort of created an environment that's in a critical state. And with the new changes to the regulatory landscape via CMMC, that means that there are going to be some immediate concerns for our business, for the DIB itself, and for how we're going to approach the problem overall. So we have a lot of information to cover, but hopefully we can do so in a quick manner. So the things that we're going to cover today are a brief timeline of how we ended up in this situation. A lot of people don't know where certain terms came from, why certain organizations and elements within the regulatory landscape are who they are, or how they are related to each other. And so the pieces that we're going to talk about are the CUI rule, what it is and where it came from, NIST Special Publication 800-171, which some people may be familiar with, as well as the DFARS clause that is actually in your contracts that says you need to implement 800-171. These get confused very often. Very often when we interact with folks in the field, we have to sort of clarify what the difference is and the relationship is between these two items, and so we're going to do that today. Then once we paint the picture of how these pieces of regulation and the landscape are all interconnected and where they came from, I'll try to visualize what this looks like, because it gets a little in the weeds of this regulation points here and it stems from this. So we're going to try to zoom out and paint a picture of what it actually might look like in a simple model. And then once we have drawn the tree and climbed the tree, we're going to throw rocks at you while you're up there and really sort of bring the bad news of what the implications of CMMC mean for folks who need to worry about DFARS and NIST compliance. And then we'll have some key takeaways and some actual tangible next steps for things that you can do in order to try to get ahead of this problem. So let's jump right into it. How did we get into this situation? The term controlled unclassified information, or CUI, actually stems all the way back from the 9/11 Commission report, when it was identified that the government had a massive information sharing problem. And as a result, there were a series of pieces of legislation that identified that there was a thing known as sensitive but unclassified information, and that this sensitive but unclassified information needed to be injected into an information sharing environment across the government, as well as across the executive branch agencies. And so as a result, there was a series of presidential memorandums that tried to create a framework and an environment for information sharing that was specifically built around the idea of terrorism-based sensitive but unclassified information. In 2008, there was actually a what we would now think of as sort of a crude framework for what they then changed the name to, controlled unclassified information, in order to try to facilitate this process. In 2009, when the administration changed, there was a presidential memorandum that said, what is the status of this process that we've been working on for so long? And it turned out that while each of the individual executive agencies had taken this mission up, they had all done it individually. And so there were over 100 different markings and procedures for how to handle and share and safeguard sensitive but unclassified information, which was then considered controlled unclassified information. And that wasn't efficient. That wasn't getting anyone where they needed to go. And so as a result, the presidential memorandum asked for an interagency task force to investigate this process and come up with, or analyze the process and come up with, some recommendations. They came up with 40 recommendations in a report on the controlled unclassified information sharing environment. And then the big bang happens as far as we're concerned with how it affects our lives. And in 2010, Executive Order 13556 was issued, and it said that not only are we going to take the previous CUI framework, we're going to create a public CUI registry in the name of government transparency, and that CUI isn't just going to be terrorism-based information, but the most valid form of CUI could be almost anything that an executive agency interacts with that is sensitive but unclassified. NARA, which was the agency that got tapped to originally create this process, sort of got elevated by this executive order, and they were put in charge of coordinating all of the executive agencies and issuing guidance and making sure that this expansion and solidification of the framework actually came to fruition. And so at the speed of government, 6 years later, a series of three things all happen in sequence here on this timeline, but they effectively happen simultaneously within government speed. The first is that in October of 2016, the DFARS regulation gets finalized, and we're going to talk about what that actually looks like. In November, the CUI rule, which is really where all of this stems from, It's because this is the rule that came from the executive order, that came from the interagency task force, that came from the memoranda, and so on and so forth, backward through time, gets finalized, and we're going to look at exactly what that means. And then NIST Special Publication 800-171 gets issued. So if you pick any one of these three elements and you just go read it, it may not make sense how they're actually related. So let's dive into each one of them. The first one being the CUI rule. Now, the CUI rule is humongous. It's relatively dry and relatively dense. I don't know how many people are in the habit of reading rules that get published in the Federal Register, but I would recommend that everyone do so because there are numerous questions that involve CUI as it affects small defense manufacturers that are at least addressed in some manner by the CUI rule. This is where really all of it emanates from for what we're concerned with today. And within the CUI rule, there's effectively three things that we're concerned with. The first being definitions, the definition of CUI itself, some categories, and some safeguarding considerations. Now, the definition of CUI is usually something most folks haven't seen before. Unfortunately, when you go actually find the definition of CUI, you'll notice that it's pretty nebulous, and this is going to be a pattern that we see emerge while we talk about these different portions of the regulatory landscape. What that means for you is that you're probably not going to be an exception to the rule because the type of business and type of information that you work with are going to fall under this broad umbrella. The CUI categories were all of the categories of sensitive but unclassified information that were coordinated together when we expanded the idea away from terrorism information. There are many, but the one that we are primarily concerned with is the defense subset of CUI, which is known as controlled technical information. And controlled technical information is really all of the technical specifications, the drawings, the blueprints, manuals, process sheets, software, pretty much anything that a small manufacturer is going to be receiving and using to create or process or machine or whatever it is that your business does, you are receiving CTI, which is a subset of CUI because it is in the overall registry, but just one piece of the expanded environment of CUI information. And then safeguarding. In the CUI rule, the safeguarding portion tells us that we are going to have to take reasonable precautions to guard against the disclosure of this information because it's sensitive and that it's categorized at a moderate level of confidentiality, which we're going to talk about in a moment, and that 800-171 are the requirements that we need to use in order to protect that information on non-federal systems, which would be your information systems. So this part of the CUI rule is what points to 800-171. So if we go look at 800-171, it'll tell us what it is that we need to do. And it is important to understand how 800-171 was actually developed, because as we'll see, the method that we use to develop 800-171 is really the first step that gets us put into a sticky situation. So when we create the set of controls and the set of security baselines that we need to apply to a federal information system, there are many documents like the FIPS documents, NIST Special Publication 853. They're humongous. There's 3,000 some odd controls. It's a big process. But that's obviously too big of a burden to apply to a non-federal manufacturing system, especially when we only have to protect a certain type of information, and especially when we only have to protect the confidentiality of that information rather than the integrity or the availability or all of those things. And so as a result, when we look at what we would normally do for a federal system, the government decided that we were going to tailor out or remove pieces of these requirements in order to create something more acceptable that would actually get implemented. So the first thing that they did in this tailoring process was remove anything that had to do with integrity or availability. And then the next thing they did was remove anything that was strictly federal information protection or anything that didn't specifically have to do with CUI. And then afterwards, they made some assumptions about what companies are already doing in their information, or their IT programs or their security programs that would likely double dip for protections on this data. And then as a result, when you tailor all those controls out, you end up with a small subset of controls. And that's how we got 800-171, which is only 14 families rather than 18. It's only 110 requirements rather than several thousand. And it can roughly be divided into 60% policy and management and about 40% technology or technical controls. There's some room for debate there, but that's roughly how it works. Now, this is where things get a little sticky, because the funny thing about making assumptions about what is happening in a set of elements that you are regulating is that you don't know for sure if those assumptions are true. And so there were 63 assumptions that were made about non-federal organizations and the controls or the security requirements that they would normally be implementing that shouldn't have had to be specified in this reasoning. And the one I would like to talk about today falls under the family of system and services acquisition, specifically the ninth one. And that one says that organizations would require their external service providers to comply with the security standards that they are required to comply with, that they would be monitoring the compliance of their external providers on an ongoing basis, and that your service level agreements or your contract or whatever your agreement mechanism is would set the expectation of performance, and that you would be able to remediate any problems that came up in this process of compliance with these third parties. Now, this isn't specified that you need to do it. It was assumed that if you were using a third party, of course you would be doing it because of the nature of the risk that is brought on by interfacing with a third party. And we're going to follow up on this assumption in a little while. So the CUI rule tells us that there are things that we need to do, that we are going to do. The NIST Special Publication 800-171 says this is how you do this. This is how you do safeguarding. And the DFARS clause that we'll talk about right now is how those requirements actually get to your desk. This disclosure in your contracts is actually how you receive this requirement. So there are 13 paragraphs in DFARS 7012, which is what I'll just call it for the sake of this brief. However, there are basically three sections of the regulation that actually concern us today. The first one is paragraph B, which says you will use adequate security to protect the confidentiality of CUI. But this is easy to understand because it just says use the 800-171 controls, which we just talked about. There's another caveat to it that says if you're going to use an external cloud service provider, that it needs to be FedRAMP moderate. The only thing that means is that there is an equivalency between the protection level of FedRAMP moderate and the protection level of 800-171. FedRAMP moderate was a standard that came out prior to the development of this or somewhat simultaneously. So rather than make those companies get certified twice under two different standards, they just said you can draw a line between the two of them. And that if you use a cloud service provider, they need to uphold paragraphs C through G. So what does that mean? Well, paragraph C says that you have a cyber incident reporting requirement, and that if you discover an incident, you need to tell the government within 72 hours. The next paragraph says that if you find malicious software in the course of investigating that incident that you've reported, you need to submit it to the DoD Cyber Crime Center. The next paragraph says that you need to preserve the images, the logs, the information for up to 90 days, because paragraph F says that you will provide additional access to other information or equipment if a forensic analysis and investigation needs to occur. And paragraph G says that if the DoD decides to do that investigation and that analysis, that you're going to provide them with that 90 days of information that you saved from paragraph E. Now, when we go out into the field and we work with small manufacturers, almost everyone, if they are even familiar with 800-171, which is in their contracts, hyper focuses on paragraph B and the security controls. I don't know if that's because it's more tangible or if that's just they're so overwhelmed by the regulation when they first read it that they just focus on that. But paragraphs C through G are equally important obligations within your contract as paragraph B. That's why the regulation is called Safeguarding Covered Defense Information and Cyber Incident Reporting. They are equally important. You have to do all of them. I have not interacted with a single small manufacturer out in the field on an engagement where they have met the requirements of paragraphs C through G out of the box. the level of compliance with those paragraphs is effectively 0%. If you were to break down the 110 controls and say that folks have X percent of them implemented when we show up to work with them, the running average at this point is around 30%. We have never worked with an organization that has had more than 75% of the controls implemented, and I've never heard of an organization that is that has 100% of the controls implemented, despite that being the requirement. So you might be wondering what paragraph M has to say, and it is true that just like all the other paragraphs, it is equally as valid and just as much of an obligation as all of the other things that we need to do. So paragraph M concerns subcontracts. And if you've heard of the concept of flow down in government contracts, this is the mechanism that flows things down. And this is the second part where we start to get into a dicey situation. This paragraph says that the contractor will include the whole clause, so all the paragraphs, including paragraph M, so it acts like a daisy chain as it gets pushed down, for operationally critical support, or for contracts in which performance involves covered defense information. What the heck is covered defense information? Covered defense information is effectively the same thing as CUI. For our purposes here, it's the same thing as CTI, all of your manufacturing-specific information. The reason why it has a different term is that the DoD was simultaneously working on this sensitive but unclassified information process during that gap of 5 years. When we were creating the CUI registry, they wanted to go faster. Everything synced up at the end in 2016, but they kept their term. That's the only reason why it's in there. The reason why this is important is that it is supposed to be a function of your course of doing business where you are flowing down these requirements to your subcontractors or for contract performance, which will include covered defense information. So when we take the fact that we have all self-attested to the idea that we are doing this process with the assumptions that we were managing our third parties on an ongoing basis, you might see where the problem begins to emerge over the last 3 years, where everyone thought that we were managing our third parties. We all attested to the idea that we were managing our third parties, but as you might guess, we haven't been doing that. And so really, that's how the regulations look in terms of how they interact with each other on the timeline, but what do they look like visually? And this might help close the loop for everyone. So when we think of information flow through the supply chain, we often think of it in the same way that we imagine production in the supply chain, and that is you have some amount of tiers of sub-suppliers and subcontractors, and production flows down through the supply chain. In this case, it flows through the supply chain as a result of paragraph M flow down mechanisms, because we're specifically concerned about CUI coming to a certain company. They process it in a certain way. They send it down. It gets processed in another way or machined. Who knows what it is? And eventually, you're going to reach the end of this supply chain. And at that point, the production will cease and the product moves back up. So this is a perfectly valid idea of how the supply chain works, but it is too narrow because it doesn't take into consideration the total flow of information through the supply chain. Because when you get low enough down in the supply chain, most companies don't run their own IT operations. They rely on what is known as a managed service provider. This is a third-party IT department, essentially. It's an external company that you pay to run your IT. And this is a very, very common setup. And really, at the lower levels of the supply chain that we're concerned with, the small suppliers are effectively inseparable from the idea of a third-party IT department. It doesn't mean that they have a specific one, but they really don't exist without those IT companies because they don't run their own program. These managed service providers have privileged access into the network of these small suppliers. And as a result, the common architectures for how they are related, the nature of their relationship, means that CUI, CDI, CTI flows to them. What's worse is that these MSPs often use a fourth party cloud service provider on the back end. And so as a result, they also receive this CUI and CTI. However, you might be able to notice where the problem is. We've got a bit of a last mile problem, if you will, in the fact that if the flow down does not continue to that managed service provider and then subsequently to the cloud service provider, we get into a bit of a pickle. So if we zoom in on what that looks like, for a small supplier, you have your attack surface. This is effectively all of the things that could possibly go wrong for your company from a cybersecurity perspective. When you interface with a third party that has privileged access, you magnify your attack surface or all of the things that could possibly go wrong. A very interesting but separate topic is all of the things that could go wrong with MSPs because they represent choke points in the supply chain. They service many companies, and so as a result, they are ideal targets on the terrain for cyber criminals or nation state actors to target. And it's a very scary thing to investigate, but that would probably be a different brief. What's important for today is that you're still receiving CUI that you need to work with in the course of doing business. And so as a result, you have compliance obligations and theoretically a compliance boundary on your systems. But when that information flows to your external provider, who is really inseparable from the architecture of your company, the compliance boundary also extends to them because the flow down is supposed to extend to them. So we know that most companies are not doing their flow down. I have never come across a company in the course of doing engagements in the field where they are even aware that this obligation is in their contracts. And as a result, we know that those companies are not DFARS 7012 compliant. That is a problem because they need to be. They have the information. I have never interacted in the course of working with small manufacturers with MSPs that they work with who are DFARS 7012 compliant, and some of them cannot even become DFARS 7012 compliant due to the nature of their business and the technologies that they've employed. On the back end, if they use a fourth-party cloud service provider, remember paragraph B says they need to be FedRAMP moderate, and they need to be able to support paragraphs C through G. If they don't get the flow down and we don't have assurances that that's happening, then they are also not compliant. This is a common reason why there are only a few cloud service offerings that are actually DFARS compliant, despite the fact that they might be very secure, which is a whole other topic. Remember that we said that around 60% of the requirements in 800.171 are management and policy, but almost half of them regard the technical or technological implementations that you need to maintain in order to be in compliance. If you are inseparable from this external party, that means that almost half of your compliance posture is in the hands of a company that you are supposed to be managing. This is why it was a reasonable assumption on NIST's part that you would be doing this, that you would be extending this obligation to them via an SLA or a contract or some sort, because it poses a humongous risk to your organization, not just from a cybersecurity perspective, but also from a cybersecurity compliance perspective. So this is normally where this brief would end, because the so what of this problem is, well, what's going to happen? Okay. So outside of the very rare chance that a government auditor is going to show up on your door under their DFARS hat and say, tell me what's going on with your cybersecurity, which as a small manufacturer is a very low likelihood, there's the potential for getting wrapped up in false claims actions, because if you falsely attest that you are compliant with your DFARS obligations and it turns out that you are not, there's a whole slew of scary fines and penalties that have been levied against companies that have done that type of false attestation. But the chances of that happening are relatively small. So it's a very low likelihood event, but it's a huge impact event. And so now we are thoroughly up in the branches of the tree. So let's talk about what the implications of CMMC mean for that low probability event. And before I deliver the bad news, we will all laugh together at this silly comic. It's a common phenomenon that we end up with multiple frameworks. So anyways, CMMC is a humongous topic in and of itself, its own webinar that would probably take up to an hour to explain. It's a large standard. It's relatively complicated. It uses lots of new vocabulary. But what we are concerned with today is that if you are a small manufacturer and you use CUI in the course of doing business, you will need to be what is known as CMMC Level 3 or ML3 certified in order to continue receiving and processing CUI. So the relationship between CMMC and DFARS is somewhat convenient because there is a huge overlap in the requirements that you need to implement. Namely, the majority of them fall under the controls in 800.171. There's really only a delta of about 20 or so things that you need to do above and beyond 800.171 in order to be CMMC level 3 certified. However, DFARS, remember, relied on self-attestation. We have these contract disclosures. We check the box that says we're using adequate security, and nobody ever really follows up. We all know that a lot of companies have checked this box. They are not compliant with their obligations. And over the last 3 years, since the requirement has been in black and white, the defense industrial base continues to have its lunch eaten by China and Russia and cyber criminals, either extorting them via ransomware or exporting, CUI and their intellectual property, basically ad nauseum. CMMC changes this because they say, we are going to verify via independent third-party auditors that you are actually compliant the way that you say you are. So in DFARS, they have this mechanism known as a POAM, or a plan of action and milestones. And that says that if you have gaps in your compliance posture that you haven't implemented yet, as long as you have a plan and a timeline for implementing them, that's good enough. As long as you address the entire body of your obligations and you implement them in a timely manner, everything's good. However, since there was no one auditing you, you could just have a license to kick the can down the road, and most folks did. CMMC changes that because on assessment day, on certification day, when the auditors show up, you are not allowed to have a POAM. You have to be 100% compliant with DFARS obligations. The real kicker here is that in order to be certified, you have to, in order to bid on contracts for which you will be receiving CUI, you have to have your CMMC level 3 certification before you are allowed to bid. So you need to be fully compliant, audited, and certified before you are allowed to receive information from your upstream customers, before you're allowed to send information to your downstream processing houses, or before you're allowed to bid on additional work. So what that means in the scope of this flow of information through the industrial base is that we now know that if our third-party external service providers fall under this compliance regime, then they also need to be CMMC level 3 certified. That is a massive problem because they are not. We are not holding them to account in accordance with the assumptions of NIST 800.171. We are not flowing down the requirements to those organizations. And as we have seen in the field, we have worked with 3 companies now, all serviced by this one MSP that is effectively a choke point because they all run their infrastructure with this single element that was neither interested nor really capable of coming along to play in CMMC land. This is bad news because you have about 90 days or so with the current CMMC standard to remediate any issues with your audit in order to gain your certification. I have not come across a single company in the field that has needed to migrate to a new MSP that has been able to do so in less than 90 days. So this originally was a question of when we discovered that there were these companies all tied together to a single MSP, we wanted to say, well, how far back can we peel the onion? And as it turns out, this is a very widespread problem. It's highly likely that you interface with a third-party provider. The next question was, well, the nature of them receiving this information, does that obligate them to be certified? And if you do some research, it is patently obvious that they need to be certified themselves. In fact, if you go read the memorandum of understanding between the DoD and the CMMC accreditation body, which is the body responsible for training the auditors, then the 8th thing they need to do is requiring MSPs to be equivalent to CMMC level 3 within 2 years of the date of this MOU. That's slightly different from the timeline of CMMC, which we'll cover in a moment. So, what are we going to do about this problem? I think there are effectively 5 main things that you can do to head off the massive risk that this poses to an organization if you have to be CMMC certified. The first one is you need to focus on your current DFARS requirements that exist in your current contracts. A, you should do this because you have already attested to the fact that you are compliant with the DFARS. Most folks don't have a system security plan. Most folks don't even have a POAM or a plan of action milestones, let alone are they compliant with all the individual requirements. Like we said, there is a huge overlap between the DFARS requirements and the CMMC requirements, and that overlap is the NIST 800-171 requirements in your current contract. So if you focus on those, you will be able to sort of kill two birds with one stone. As a result, I would encourage everyone to go read 800-171, go to Appendix E, and look at what the 63 assumptions were that were made about your company when the standard was created, because the controls, the 110 controls in 800-171, are predicated on the idea that you are already doing those 63 things. The big one that is of concern to us is SA9, that you're managing your external parties. But there are many other things that were assumed that a rational, self-interested company in this ecosystem would be doing. And if you are not, it makes the amount of work you need to do to get into compliance with current DFAR requirements even harder. You should also establish a robust vendor management process. And what that effectively means is you are going to understand who your external vendors are, what the nature of the relationship is with them, what they do, what information is flowing to them, what information is flowing from them to you, what their accesses are, what ports and protocols they need, all this detailed information, because your risk is magnified by the external parties that interface with you. So as a result, if you're not managing that process, if that third party is critical to your business, like a downstream processing house or an MSP, then you really have no control or insight into what they're doing. And as we've seen, that can spell massive problems when the regulatory landscape shifts on us. So as a result of your vendor management process, you need to understand your flowdown requirements. Remember, all the paragraphs in DFAR 7012 are equally valid, which means you need to uphold all of them, including the last one that most people stop reading before they get to. If you are sending CUI, the common term you will hear is that the controls follow the data. If you send CUI to someone, then the controls that come with it need to follow the data. Okay. The last one is allowable costs, and I want to take a second to be very clear about this. If you research CMMC, which I hope you do, you will often hear the government say that the costs of getting into compliance are allowable, and that is absolutely true. However, remember that in order to be CMMC certified, you have to be able to get certified pre-bid. So although you can pass your costs along, you have to do so and still win your bid. The reason why there is a lot of tension growing around this situation is that the government has said, yeah, we'll have allowable costs. I mean, it's going to be like $5,000 or $6,000 for these companies to get into compliance, plus the cost of their audit. And everyone throws up their hands and they say, $5,000 or $6,000, there's no way we could get compliant for that price. And the government turns around and they said, well, right here, you self-attested that you were compliant with your DFARS requirements. There's only a few extra requirements on top of that in order for you to meet CMMC. So why would you be passing $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 in compliance remediation along to the government unless you had falsely attested to your DFARS requirements? Now, I don't think that the government might necessarily pursue anyone if they do that. What's more likely to happen is that you won't win your bid. So you will invest all of this money to overcome the existing technical debt in your system. However, you will have done so at the last minute. Another person who is bidding on that contract or looking for that work will not have waited until the last minute. Therefore, their gap in what they are going to be passing on to the government is smaller than yours. And then they will continue to operate. So it is of utmost importance, it is imperative on your ability to continue operating that you get ahead of the problem sooner rather than later. Within the overall timeline of where things are going, CMMC is still developing. There are still pieces of the accrediting body that are getting worked out. However, the DFARS rule that we talked about that gets published in the Federal Register is due to be updated in October, I believe, is when it opens for comment, which means sometime probably in Q1 2021, the current timeline says, the DFARS rule will be updated to include CMMC requirements. At that point, contract RFPs will begin flowing immediately. No one has been able to tell anyone whose RFPs will include this obligation first. They have said that it will be distributed over the course of several years, but I wouldn't take that bet, and I would encourage everyone to take a very hard look at what your current understanding is of your environment, what your current understanding is and realistic nature of your compliance posture is, and the implications of if someone says you need to be audited immediately, how likely you are to make your certification, and then how likely you are to be able to remediate in the very short timeline that CMMC gives you. So, like I said at the beginning, at no point in time have we interacted with small businesses in the field where they have been really anywhere close to the ability to meet this obligation. And so not all businesses are created equal. Perhaps you're well ahead of the curve, but I would encourage that if anyone has questions or needs clarification, training and technical assistance is what CMTC specializes in. And I hope that this helps to clarify and somewhat demystify how we ended up in this situation with CMMC. And with that, that is the end of this presentation.
Well, great, Jacob. Thank you. Great work, and what a meaty topic. So I just wanted to maybe start some Q&A, and if folks have any questions, please use the chat function. One that just came in. So from Peter, he's asking, are there any IT service providers who are marketing their ability to comply? I guess, you know, will there be a registered list of these managed service providers, maybe sanctioned by the DoD? There might be some structure there that suppliers, particularly small folks, Jacob, where you know there's going to be tremendous impact to the
right.
small machine shops of the world doing DoD work. I think there needs to be some kind of outreach. So would there be any kind of registered list of folks that maybe are approved to do this kind of work?
As of right now, there is no such list. Unfortunately, I think this is a clear situation where the model that was used to create the regulation was far too narrow. Sort of like we spoke about with that flow diagram, without a adequate understanding of what it actually looks like on the ground at the capillaries of the supply chain where we work, then you will fail to realize that I would assume the vast majority of those companies rely on these external parties. So there is a plan for creating an environment of auditors. There is a plan for creating a certified group of advisors and consultants. There is no current plan that I have seen or that my colleagues have seen that will create a marketplace of compliance certified managed service providers. Now, that's obviously a massive business opportunity for them, but it is a massive risk for us because as small manufacturers, if that doesn't come to fruition and audit day shows up and half of your controls belong to this external party and you know nothing about them, you are not going to get certified. So that is something that should exist, as of yet does not exist. And as I see Chris pointing out, given the timeline, I'm not sure that it is going to exist in time. So that is why it is of utmost importance that you take a hard look at your current situation and engage with your MSP, your downstream customers that you may send CUI to for some reason, and take a very realistic look at if you were willing to bet the ability for your business to continue operating with the DoD, what would you be willing to bet that ability on your current cybersecurity compliance and relationship with your MSP? For most people, I would advise them not to do that.
Yeah, no, good feedback. And I think Chris just pointed out, Chris Carter said, you know, don't wait. You know, it's like most things in aerospace and defense. Once there is a requirement, it tends to roll down the hill pretty quickly. And
yep.
So OEMs and tier ones will be enacting that in future RFPs. I had a question for you in regards to the Q1 implementation in 2021 on the DFARS rule in terms of compliance. What do you see in terms of impact to existing contracts? Will there be potential amendments? I mean, it just seems like if you're going to have this umbrella for cybersecurity, you're going to have a lot of holes.
Correct.
Existing contracts, and I wonder, how that might flow downhill with existing contracts.
So the official word right now on the timeline is that the time to implement CMMC will be over the course of 5 years. And the reason why OSD and the AB are saying it would take 5 years is that if you take the total set of existing contracts, the amount of time it would take for them to age off and be recompeted with their extensions and everything would be roughly 5 years before the entire ecosystem is replaced with new contracts. Now, I don't know what everyone's level of experience is with program offices at acquisition commands, but they are usually staffed by highly capable and highly motivated program managers. And in my experience working at MilSatCom with program offices for the Air Force and weapon system acquisitions, I don't know of a single program manager that would not be looking to get ahead of the game, show that they're down with the fight and that they're willing to get ahead of the curve and make their downstream supply chains comply with CMMC, even if that means they are working ahead of schedule. Will they mod all the contracts in order to include the requirement? I don't know. They certainly could. However, my gut feeling is that if you think that you are going to be in the set of people 5 years from now who get a CMMC requirement rather than the folks who get it sooner than that, you might want to reconsider that estimation, because what we're seeing now, remember when we talked about the expansion of CUI to include various categories, we are only right now thinking about DoD CTI for small manufacturers. This includes information from Department of Transportation, Department of Agriculture, FDA, food manufacturers, all kinds of stuff. The current FAR rule, which is sort of the bigger version of DFARS for all of federal acquisitions, also includes this concept of CUI. And just a few days ago, you may have seen in the headline that there are mentions of CMMC compliance for federal contracts that are non-DoD. So this isn't just a problem for DoD manufacturers. It's a problem for anyone on a federal contract. And most small businesses in any type of federal contract and acquisition are likely in the same situation where they rely on external providers. And we're seeing that one jump the gun on the date for when that's supposed to be implemented. So will they mod the contracts? Possibly. Will it show up well ahead of what the government is saying the timeline is? I would assume that it will.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think, I think it's so relevant. Even yesterday's example of how Twitter was hacked, we are in a cyber war. I mean, it is clear, and there are bad actors out there. And, let's face it, the government will probably not implement these standards very well. And, we're all vulnerable. And I guess, there's some comments here on our chat line here about, this is going to impact hundreds, probably thousands of mom and pop operations making those small machining components that they don't even have, internet-based services in their company and a lot of paper, and I guess there's the question of how would you enforce it down at that level? When there's very little infrastructure.
I'll give you a great example. So I've recently worked with a client who's a small manufacturer that receives CUI information from every major prime integrator that you could think of. That they are a precision machine shop. They have 60 some odd downstream processing houses because they machine the part, but it has to be treated. It has to be coated. It has to have all kinds of different things applied to it. A lot of the time when you send that spec to that downstream processing house, it constitutes CUI. Remember the very nebulous definition that this could fall under. They also use an MSP. If an auditor were to walk into an organization and you say, we send CTI to 60 some odd processors downstream from us and to our MSP, and we have no idea what the security posture is with those organizations who get it or what our relationship is with them, and we've never flowed down this requirement, that's going to be the end of the conversation. Mm-hmm. So a lot of small manufacturers, I would venture to say almost all of them, are in this situation, and unfortunately, that is the corner that we are painted into. I wish that this brief could be given to all several hundred thousand small manufacturers and let them know what's coming. But unfortunately, the DoD has made it very clear, and OSD has made it very clear, that they are not playing around. They're not willing to compromise, and they're not joking. And what I think makes this very poetic is that they seem to be the villain, right? They seem to have set us up in this situation, but really it's a series of assumptions and events that have created this environment. And what makes it a great story, if you will, I know probably not for folks listening, is that they're right. If you throw a dart at any headline over the last 3 years in which the defense industrial base has been attesting to be compliant, we are still getting smacked around by China basically all day long. And so what we're currently doing is not working. So it is correct that we need to implement auditing to verify that the controls are in place. However, the regulation that got handed down to us is such that it's probably going to be very painful in terms of how it shakes out. So I plead with people, do not wait to figure out how this is going to impact your business. And if you need help, please reach out so that we can try to clarify what's going on, because your intuitions of worst case scenario are probably true.
Yeah, I think that's a good message for life. Don't wait. We're in a pandemic. Act before it becomes a really big situation. There was a question from Howard Miller about, you know, what does it mean to hardware? You know, a lot of us are doing smart technologies, embedded chips and software, and ultimately, you know, that information or how those work could be compromised as well. That's probably a whole nother topic that we could have another session on, but do you have a sense on potential impact, and not just COI controlled information on drawings, et cetera, but the hardware itself?
Sure. So yeah, for Howard's question there, in terms of your OT environment, your actual manufacturing shop floor environment, not just your IT environment, the unfortunate answer is CMMC does not address your operational technology whatsoever, despite the fact that the CUI flows into your OT network, which, as you might think, if you put your auditor hat on, is going to be a massive problem, because there is no guidance on what your OT network really needs to look like or needs to do, but the information flows over there and you're still obligated to protect it. So how are the auditors going to interpret that little wrinkle in this standard? And nobody knows at this point, because the body of auditors has not even been trained yet. We don't know what auditing standards they're going to use. So a massive problem with the CMMC standard in terms of regulating OT infrastructure. Yet again, another hole in the model that was likely used in its development, because this will have an outsized impact on small manufacturers who all have OT environments that contain CUI, and yet the regulation addresses it not at all. I'm sorry, that's my answer.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I know, as I was in a previous role as a chief technology officer for a company called Capstone Turbine, and I was contacted by the Department of Homeland Security one afternoon about a hacking of one of our turbines. So it was a big reaction on, you know, what do we do next?
The threat briefs, you know, are fascinating. And if you go back, if anybody here has access to the A&D Forum archive back in November, I gave a brief called The War Before the War, specifically concerning some of the larger systemic threats facing the industrial base. That was back in November for San Diego, which may be of interest for folks if you want to catch up. And as always, if that's a brief that anyone is interested in, feel free to reach out, because talking about the threats is really the fun part, if you will, because there's a never-ending stream of scary things going on out in the world.
Indeed. Well, thank you, Jacob. Again, what a wonderful summary. You're a tremendous speaker, and want to thank you for your time in presenting this. I know it's a big pill to swallow, And I hope all of those on the phone call can spread the message. CMTC is going to be part of our network list, so I would encourage you to reach out to Kathy McIntyre, to Jacob on further questions. We may decide to have a future session on this as we get closer to the Q1 DFLR implementation. So once again, Jacob, thank you for your time. Really appreciate it. Just some upcoming chapter meetings. We are continuing our journey via Zoom. I think we're getting a good handle on this, and we have some additional great conversations on space. There's a lot going on, a lot of disruption. Boy, I think about A&D in general the last 25 years plus that I've been in it, and you know, the last couple have been just so disruptive with technology, cybersecurity, obviously the pandemic, and all of the above. And so we're going to continue our journey. In fact, tomorrow there is a discussion on frequent and reliable small launch. The commercialization of space is here, and so that's exciting. So that's a joint venture there between a couple of chapters. And then on the 22nd of July, Space is a New Market, Part 1. We're going to have multiple parts to that as a national chapter session. And then in August, we're going to have part 2 on that journey as well. So I want to encourage you to check us out online on the Aerospace Defense Forum. This chapter session is recorded and will be available within the next few days with the presentation material. So a lot of meaty material there. I would encourage you to go back and probably pre-review some of the regulations that Jacob just quickly was able to get off of his tongue. And so we're all debriefed there. Also want to encourage you to join as a member. $350 a year is the fee. It gives you unlimited access to all of the chapter sessions, including the national sessions that we do. If that's not amenable to you, we do a $25 per session for non-members to access certain topics. So with that, I want to thank you. Have a wonderful and safe week, and we hope to see you next time. Thank you.